Well, hello everyone, and welcome. We're going to be talking today about NRX, which was something that was kind of doing the rounds online, 10 years ago, 5 years ago. It kind of had it was kind of a thing in 2008, 2009, 2010, and then it had a resurgence around 2020, 2021, 22, including lots of people who used to come on this channel as well, and Curtis Yarvin himself. And we're going to really have a think about NRX thought and what was really going on there, because Todd has some theories. Before we get going, I'll remind people, my new book, Foundations of Shakespeare, it's not even out yet, but you can get it on pre-order. If you own the course, you get 50% off, and I've extolled the virtues of this volume. Already, it's really nicely done. I love the illustrations and things they put in there. And speaking of Curtis Yarvin, he's actually in my ad because it's promo code Shawjan at the moment. It's a 25% off all courses. So we're going to see a bit of Yarvin and then we're going to talk about him. Take it away.
Sure. Sure, 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 sure. And so, sure.
Sure, Jan.
Can you command a comma like Joseph Conrad?
Sure, Jan.
Are you magnificent in your mastery of marginalism like Murray Rothbard?
Sure, Jan.
Are you legendary in your logical leveling of lamentable loquacity?
Sure, Jan.
Come on down to the January sale at the Academic Agency. Promo code Shawjan for 25% off. All this January, I got more courses than the Queen had horses.
Sure, Jan.
I got better rates than Andrew Tate's ad mates.
Sure, Jan.
I got better deals than Lizzo's had meals.
Sure.
Sure, Jan.
And so, sure, 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 and so, sure, sure.
All right, so you in the ad, that was the time I talked to Curtis Yarvin. I actually had him on to talk about Thomas Carlyle. And that is actually where I found Yarvin personally was interesting, was introducing certain interesting authors, okay, Carlyle being the main one. There's a few other people he cited here and there who I got into as well. Although, contrary to popular opinion, he didn't really cite the elite theorists that much. And it was me who wrote the book Populist Illusion, if you remember, because in a way I wanted to get away from some of the annoying tendencies that I had with NRX. One of the irritations I had with it, as a student of good, clear prose style, was the amount of obfuscation, of convoluted kind of Silicon Valley, California slang, internet writing. I could never get on with it. I like straight to the point. You get it. You can read a sentence and know exactly what I'm talking about. Straight away. Okay, that's one thing. Another thing is that he has this habit, which I've noticed a lot of people of his background and ilk do. Bronze Age pervert does this as well. I think it's a Straussian thing, but I could be wrong. Is that they like to omit their references, i.e., they take ideas from places where I, as someone from an academic background, will give you the bibliography, right? Pages and pages and pages of it. They will basically hide where they've got it from, pass it off as their own idea or not give due, etc. So what I wanted to do here was basically just cut through all of that and give you the core of proper elite theory, minus the drivel, minus the nonsense, minus the other weird little things like, you know, it's all emergent and various other little irritations I had, the fetishization of technology and things like that that came with NRX too. That's what I was trying to do. But you've now gone back and started reassessing, and you've got some of your own ideas, don't you?
Yeah, so I was, NRX was one of the dominant forces when I first experienced the online riot in 2011. Now, of course, it goes back to 2007 with Moldbug's unqualified reservations. The interesting thing is I and a friend about two or three years ago went through and read all of 2007 UR to see, okay, what exactly is Moldbug? Because to your point, Moldbug does write in this confusing, disjointed, unclear pattern. And I'm like, well, wait, does this, because I've got it all secondhand from people who read Moldbug. I'm like, well, okay, is the source any clearer? Like, can we get some focus here? No, it's not. It's actually less clear, but there are things that I've learned, right? So let's use the sort of exoteric angle here. So exoterically, Moldbug is talking about power, politics, economics, and a certain reading of history. Initially, my engagement with that was that a lot of this was just factually incorrect. It was just wrong. So, I mean, a good example of the factual incorrectness would be there is no connection between corporations and monarchies in the way he wants. The bourgeois revolutions of the 17th, 18th, and early 19th centuries in England, France, the United States, and Latin America toppled these imperial autocratic regimes. They were at loggerheads. These are not, more of the same. They're just not. They were hostile classes when the bourgeoisie was establishing itself. That's just completely wrong. Another thing that's just completely wrong is how Moldbug treats Carlyle. Carlyle was a critic of capitalism. He called laissez-faire capitalism the dismal science, economics, right? He came up with the cash nexus theory, which was later appropriated by Karl Marx and Engels. There's just, if you read Carlyle, it's completely not what... See, Moldbug doesn't really cite Carlyle very much. So when he says, oh, I'm telling you what Carlyle would say, you don't really know that unless you read Carlyle. So like if you were to read On Heroes and Hero Worship, Carlyle is very friendly to the idea of the Protestants, whereas Moldbug in his NRX creates a very unfriendly portrayal. And it's all sort of wrapped up in common sense Carlyle thought. And it's like, well, no, Carlyle was a huge fan of Oliver Cromwell and collected all of his letters and viewed him as one of the great men of history. So Carlyle's really not anything like what Moldbug or NRX is, well, even though appealing to Carlyle was sort of how he gained credibility.
It's worth mentioning that I remember that essay in UR, because it's called From Mises to Carlyle, if you remember. And as somebody who wrote an entire book on Austrian Econ, Defenders of Liberty, overpriced, not often read by these days, but you know, I have a pretty strong background in libertarian economics. Yarvin had this line where he's like, oh, Carlyle and Mises frequently disagreed, and where they disagreed, Mises was almost certainly correct. And I'm like thinking, now I've read both of them, right? Years later, you've read, and then you think, hold on a second. Mises and Carlyle basically disagree on everything. There's not like a single thing that like Mises is literally a prototypical liberal through and through, right? In his political theory, he's an ardent Democrat. He's an ardent liberal. You know, he's laissez-faire. He's free trade. He's, you know, he basically ends up in, you know, he's basically like an all open borders libertarian. Right, I know some Mises people won't be happy with that. But if you go back and read Mises, he's reacting very strongly against the nationalist current in Europe in the 30s for obvious reasons. And he's extolling the virtues of the free market. And he does this lecture tour in the 50s and so on. And his doctrine is one that Carlyle would have called Mammonism. He would have called it nomadism. He would have called it, selling out to the great cash nexus. I mean, he would have been disgusted at me. Like they would have been arch enemies. Not to mention the fact that Carlyle was not a fan of the sort of people that Mises, like the sort of the ethnic background that Mises came from as well, on top of everything else. So, yeah, I mean, it's that's one of the strangest sentences in Yavin for me. Is like, well, I mean, if you take it, if you say that where they disagree, Mises is always correct, you're just saying that Mises is always correct because they disagree on everything.
Yeah. Right. And that's one of the, on the exoteric level, that's what really would get my goat. It's like, look, either Moulbouk has never read Carlyle at all, or he has and is deliberately falsifying what Carlyle stated, because Carlyle just did not take any of these positions. And I do remember when he said that passage about Moulbouk, Mises and Carlyle. Now Carlyle's a reactionary, and of course, near reaction, okay, they want to then take that reactionary line. But a real reactionary, like Carlyle, has economic policies much closer to Karl Marx, because Karl Marx appropriated a lot of his ideas and writes favorably about Carlyle's take on economic realities. And so a quote-unquote intellectual reactionary would not be pro-capital. And historically, the entrenched political reactionary class was opposed to the bourgeois revolution, which represents what Moulbouk is trying to defend with, you know, libertarian capitalist rhetoric. And so there's just no connection here. And now, okay, well, then what is he doing? Well, let's look at the esoteric. Some of it he does tell you. So he has an essay in 2007 where he talks about how he doesn't like the ethno-nationalist, white nationalist critique of his people. And so he basically admits to initiating this Puritan thesis in order to distract attention away from people pointing the finger at his people. He says that. So, okay, that's one esoteric reality where while he gets a lot of factual beliefs, you know, he talks about hyper-Calvinism, a lot of beliefs are not stated correctly. The main point here is that he's not appealing to hyper-Calvinism as a historical reality based on an accurate understanding of the theology. He's creating a bogeyman in order to deflect attention away from people pointing the finger at his people. Now, that's where he actually states it. Now, other places he doesn't. And you have to kind of read between the lines. So why would you get Carlyle and induct him onto team capitalism? And why would you call this reaction? I think if we go, and I'm not saying this was Moldbug's plan, but if we look at the landscape of thinking or thought that we're living in now, right? We're living in what Deleuze called a deterritorialized state where ideas and symbols don't cohere to each other anymore, and they're not cohering to anything real. Now we're talking about Baudrillard's simulacra. So you have all these free-floating ideas that aren't really tied down to what they once represented. And, you know, the history bro, the right-wing guy, all of these guys who read history, especially military history, they always, you know, I used to do this too, right? We'd LARP as the historical characters or figures we read about. So you can sort of weaponize that and say, you know, oh, it's a Draca novel now, right? We have the South Africans, the Tories, all the historical losers who team up to defeat, you know, the global American liberal system. And you create this grab bag of history's losers, you know, that create the roster list for Moldbug's neo-reactionary army, if you will. And so these people then can just sock themselves in there. They think they're doing one thing, which is fighting, you know, liberalism, socialism, the revolution. But what they're really doing is just defending the status quo. Right. And so they don't realize that, though. At least they're not supposed to. That's the theory that I'm running with, because early on in 2007, there's a nudge-nudge, wink-wink moment where Moldbug says, oh, yeah, I have an uncle or some relative in the Council on Foreign Relations. And he says, if the Council on Foreign Relations shows up in the news, then you know that's where the real event is going to happen. And I thought, well, that's a little hard to ignore.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things. I mean, I should mention the other times where the esoteric Yavin comes to the fore, we could say. Famously, there was the Hobbits and the Owls essay. Do you remember that?
Oh, yes. Yeah, that was a big stink.
Right. That was one. Another one is actually just this past week, just before the Venezuela thing happened, he wrote this big essay, the upshot of which, by the way, is that the Trump revolution has failed, and now we need to look out, because if the Democrats get back in, we're all going to go to jail, which was basically to scare people to get back into to get back into the reservation of voting with the GOP, because they're going to face a wipeout, right? But ostensibly, he was saying, like, oh, right, we fished in the Rubicon, we didn't take over the regime, and now when the regime gets back in, you know, when the Democrats get back in, we're all going to go to jail. That was the upshot of it. I don't think that's going to happen, by the way, but I think he was basically using fear to try to get people to refocus on taking on the Democrats, okay? But then he made a couple of tweets after that talking about Hitler, which was a little bit strange, because the upshot of that was, look, if Hitler's going to come, we might as well control him. I.e., better to have, like, rather than actual Hitler, Hitler that we control, which I found was, one, really quite a kind of mask off and strange thing to say, especially just after he'd been on the BBC, right, the previous night or whatever. But secondly, a lot of people picked up on this comment. Many thousands of people picked up on it. You know, and if you relate it back to hobbits and elves, you know, he's basically saying, well, you know, people like me get to rule people like you.
Yeah.
And you're better off.
Yeah.
If we're in charge type thing. So yeah, I just thought I'd mention those things. I want to steel man him a bit, right? I'm going to try to use my knowledge of Carlyle and my knowledge of Yarvin to try to steel man his argument. If you understand Carlyle correctly, he's saying, look, this is a really, and he's writing in the mid 19th century. He's saying the old world order is being torn to shred by the cash nexus. The old aristocracy is rotten and was correctly purged with fire in the French Revolution. In Britain, the old aristocracy is absent, right? I'm reminded of, do you ever see Devil's Advocate with Al Pacino?
No.
All right, but there's a moment in that movie where Al Pacino, who's playing a character called John Milton, but he's basically Satan in that film. And he says, look, who can deny that the 20th century was all mine? And then he starts having a rant against God. Satan does. Okay. And he says he's an absentee landlord. Right. And in a way, a lot of Carlyle's stuff is about how the British aristocracy in the 19th century had become absentee landlords. In some cases, quite literally, they were like in the valleys where my mother was from, where all the coal mines were. All these coal mines were owned by some landlord, right? In some cases, they wouldn't visit for years on end. They didn't invest capital into those places. They were gambling or womanizing or, you know, living a jolly in the Ritz or something. They weren't acting as good kind of feudal lords to their little area, okay? So what Carlyle was arguing for was for the captains of industry, the tycoons, the capitalists, to step up, given that they already had adopted the trappings of a feudal state, whether it's the factory or the coal mine or whatever. They need to step up and become the aristocrats of now. That's basically what Carlyle is arguing for when he's going on about Bobus Higgins and Sausage Maker on the Great Scale. He's like, look, yeah, great. You need to be more than that. If you are our elites now, if you are the new aristocracy, you actually need to step up and recognize your social obligations and your social bonds as the old feudal lords used to do. That is basically, and I remember back when I was actually in touch with Yarvin, in fact, this was around the time that he stopped replying, because I said to him, look, is the reason that Peter Thiel is so up for your stuff is because, you know, he's your captain of industry and, you know, you're encouraging him to be the new feudal lord. I never got a reply to that, but it could well be that this is where he's got, like, that's the basic idea he wants to take. And he sees the Elon Musks and the Peter Thiels as the captains of industry and the new feudal lords going forward. In a way, you'll own nothing and you'll be happy, right? As per the WEF. But you'll be happy because your feudal lord actually looks out for your interests and maintains social obligations, something like this.
Well, it seems what I would say here is that the audience that you're talking about, what Carlyle is speaking to, is what he sees as a rising group of people that could become a new class. They're not yet a new class, but they could be. I would say that, especially with the hobbits versus elves argument, Moldbug is actually, I think, saying the opposite. He's saying to all the right-wing supporters he had for years, hey, you're not going to be in charge. I am. See, because the dark elves are still a part of that upper crust elite. They're just misunderstood, I guess, like him, right? That's how he tells it. So it seems like he's really telling whoever could be the new rising class, no, keep your head down. We're still in charge, and we're going to stay in charge. That's what I got from Moldbug on that one. But the other thing, too, Carlyle is just a gift that keeps on giving. The other thing that Moldbug is, because of the whole, you know, Teal connection and Moldbug being a computer programmer and a nerd and all that, is technology. And you get that a lot in UR. He really loves technological progress, which one is progressive, which is interesting. Progressives love technological progress too. So there's that. And then second of all, Carlyle was a severe critic of technology. He writes in Sign of the Times, one of the earliest systematic critiques of what industry was doing to the country. So now he's shifting away from a critique of capital to a critique of technology. And that's even, I think, more anathema to someone like Moldbug, who would tote, of course, Carlyle, but his beliefs are completely opposite Carlyle's. I think Carlyle serves as a token of some kind. Oh, he's a reactionary. But Moldbug doesn't know what that means on an intellectual level, or he does, and then he's just not telling you for ulterior motives. You know, we don't know which of those two it is.
Mm-hmm. What about some of his other famous phrases? Like, one of the ones is Cthulhu swims solely, but it always swims left. Right? That was something that he said for a long time. And, I mean, he was influential. I mean, Arrow McIntyre still quotes Yavin. I see Dave Distributis still quotes Yavin. A lot of other people have kind of don't bother with him anymore, but those two, I still take note of what he says, right? I mean, would Carlyle not agree that Cthulhu? I mean, certainly, viewed from Carlyle's perspective, a lot of the predictions he made ended up coming true, even though they were very pessimistic from his point of view, from Carlyle's point of view. So, yeah. Any thoughts on this?
Well, that would depend, right? Because for Moldbug, right, being a libertarian adjacent, I mean, obviously he's not a libertarian. He opens up by criticizing some of the more straight-line Mises types with regards to, like, the state and force. So for Moldbug, Cthulhu swimming left would be more government regulation, more government getting in the way of business, which is exactly what Carlyle wants. That's exactly what Carlyle wants. He wants the state to control capital rather than capital controlling the state. That's what Moldbug wants. And so in a sense, they would what Moldbug bemoans is not what Carlyle bemoans. Carlyle bemoans the loss of, you know, Green England to the satanic mills. Moldbug does not. And Carlyle bemoans the cash nexus, and Moldbug does not. I really think that, well, in this regard, I am glad that he introduced Carlyle, because I don't know if I'd have read Carlyle otherwise. It does seem, though, that his takes are just not Carlyle's takes.
Yeah. Why don't we come back a little bit and think about you wanted to talk about authoritarianism, right? And specifically Yavin's interest in authoritarianism. I mean, Carlyle, I would argue, was pretty authoritarian. And one of the essays that Yavin recommends of Carlyle's is Dr. Francia, right? Or Dr. Francia, who is topically a Latin American dictator, right? And Yavin says this is one of his favorite Carlyle essays. And Carlyle admires this kind of strong man, man of heroic will, if you want to put it that way, who was prepared to kind of do what it, use force to do what was required at the time. And Yavin always gestures towards this. He wraps it up in monarchy. What is the issue with this? I mean, is this not quite Carlylean?
Well, as far as Carlyle's view on the state proper, he's not, even though he has spoke favorably of the French Revolution and Napoleon in On Heroes and Hero Worship, he doesn't necessarily talk about republics. He talks about great leaders, some spiritual like Muhammad, right? And some, or I think he mentions Odin too. And then some political, like, or religious would also include Luther, but then political like Napoleon, Cromwell, and others. He definitely has a more, I guess you could say, autocratic focus. And maybe that's actually where Moldbug is getting a lot of his Carlylean stuff. Now, when it comes to the idea of a great leader who it stamps as well on history and upends a political system, there is a difference that I would say between Moldbug's use of that concept and Carlyle's. Carlyle specifically talks about like Cromwell and Napoleon, the king archetypes. He says that this is already indication of a society that has already decayed. It's insincere. He's one of the first writers that I've read that uses the term simulacra, which after I read Baudrillard, I'm like, oh, wow, this guy's using it over 100 years old, earlier than him. And so it's sort of like the emergency option. Rome and the Republic had the dictator who was in emergency position to fight against Rome's enemies whilst it was in a crisis. That's not saying that Rome at the time it had the office of dictator wanted to have a unitary ruler the whole time, just in an emergency. And I think that his great hero like that is more akin to that. It's more of an emergency. Whereas Moldbug treats like he has a hammer and every problem's a nail. We have the direct application of force through state power, or I guess private military contractors, if you want to go all that way. And that's just how things ought to be all of the time, because that's just the real world. That's a very like materialistic, pessimistic view, whereas Carlyle's not that. He's more spiritual and optimistic. Now, he's also a realist. He knows that you can't, just get rid of all of this. But the old adage, the pen is stronger than the sword, I think is something that if you read Carlyle, you'll see he leans more in that direction.
I mean, I'm trying to steel man Yavin a little bit, just so it's not, I don't want this to be like a hatchet job or something. I mean, thinking about some of the stuff he said over the years, he's always been very critical of the Republican Party or the Red America's use of power. And I remember him being critical of the repeal of Roe versus Wade, as an example. He was critical. I mean, he's generally critical whenever the right actually uses power, because he argues that it needs to be a 1-2-step process. It needs to be swift and clean and a total takeover. And that all of these kind of little uses, these petty uses of power, will just create resentment and a backlash and so on. So he doesn't say like you should always use force all the time. He says that once you have to get into a position that you can actually wield it, and that Republicans tend to wield it awkwardly or badly. So he is looking for Caesar, but he says like in order to get Caesar, it needs to be swift and clean. And now he's saying that Trump hasn't done that as well.
I think this kind of leans into the esoteric Yavin. Like, what is he really doing? So he's very critical of the liberal soft power approach in UR. So that indicates to me that even after he envisions taking power, he's going to advocate more hard power solutions. But you are right when he talks about, well, how do we get that power that we don't have? Well, first of all, with the hobbits versus elves, there isn't really the we. That was kind of just a little smokescreen there. The hobbits aren't going to get a hold of power, right? The we is Yarvin and his friends, right? That's the we. And so I believe ultimately that, okay, so let's start with this. Of all the thinkers of the online right, Yarvin, I think, was the most influential because he created the sort of thought matrix that all right-wing guys had, right? You could be, you know, a Manosphere type, a PUA type, a MGTOW type. You could be, you know, a white nationalist type, whatever, right? But everybody's using the lingo and jargon of Moldbug in a way that nobody else was, even, you know, and from other independent outlets, right? And so part of it is, I think he was trying to steer a certain element of the online population, disaffected males who were being discriminated against by, you know, political correctness and wokeism within, through the medium of the internet, because that's his area of expertise. And so a lot of the stylistic critiques that we've elucidated about how he writes was very effective, though, at, quote, programming his audience to take these ideas in. Okay. And he was very successful. And so what I think was, this was all just kind of a bait and switch. It was Lucy with the football. He's like, yeah, we're on the same team. You're my bro. We're going to get here together. We're going to overthrow woke. But what he's really doing is using these guys as his own sort of private army, shock troops. And he's already told them that they're not going to get the influence I thought they were going to get by being loyal to him with his Hobbits versus Elves essays. So when you look behind the exoteric and look at some of the stuff that maybe doesn't stand up, I think what he wanted to do, he was very successful at doing. And that was creating a mindset amongst people that could have been a threat. Let's go back to the essay where he sort of explains why he pushes the Protestant thesis. He's tired of people pointing the finger at his people. And he was really successful at that. So I think, you know, let's have a list. You know, one, deflect attention away from Yarvin and his people. Two, get a lot of these disaffected white guys in order to give him support of various kinds, and then put pressure on the establishment in general in order to help him get his goals in life. And he was very successful at that. But that's just a totally different outlook on what Yarvin is doing than you might get at first blush just by hearing it secondhand or reading it from his own blog.
Now, when I look at the lead, like who would be the ideal Yarvinian leader in current world politics, and when I have a look, I mean, again, like I mentioned, Aura McIntyre and Distributist Dave still seem like they bother with Yarvin. I don't see many other people. But it seems like the leader that they like more than any other leader is Bukele, you know, the guy in El Salvador, you know, and especially the shot of all of the MS-13 gangsters, you know, in the prison, where it's kind of quite brutal, and he's got all the prisoners lined up, okay, and law and order has been, with the iron fist, maintained in El Salvador. Would you agree that this is the closest thing to a Yarvinian leader that we have in the world?
Well, I would, yeah. Yes and no, right? So yes, in the sense that Bukele's kind of a right coded in a way that some of the people I'm going to mention are not. And in that regard, on a superficial level, that might hold better. But I actually think Kim Jong-un and Xi Jinping are far more what Yarvin is actually getting at than what we have. So one, in his UR, he talks about the importance of having power strictly defined. Like, you know, we know who has it. We know the chain of command. We know how it's used. Everything is, you know, quote, transparent. And when I did my show with my friend, we were going through this. I'm like, well, that just sounds like he wants Stalin. Everybody knows they're, you know, he's at the top. He runs the state apparatus and everybody just follows orders. And that's how North Korea and China work. And so I feel like that, and certain critics of Yarvin have pointed this out too. North Korea is actually probably the most Yarvinian state because it's just this, you know, autocratic state where everybody knows.
Monarchy.
Yeah. And a monarchy. Yeah, right. It's, and so I think that those two countries probably come closer, actually.
Interesting. Very interesting. Of course, I'll have nothing bad said about Comrade Stalin myself. Funny enough, when I looked into the ins and outs of the Soviet Union, it wasn't as simple as our little cast. We've got a kind of cartoonish picture of Stalin in our heads, but it actually took him quite, I mean, in some cases, it took him up to like 10 years to remove people from the government and things like that, which, you know, is longer than we might imagine. You know, certainly, I mean, it didn't, I'll just put it a different way. It took him quite a while to consolidate power over the Communist Party. So, you know, there's probably more to be said. I'll probably do more Stalin videos at some point this year. But I understand what you mean, right? A more autocratic dictator with one person making all the decisions at the top. And in fact, I know you also want to talk about authoritarian regimes. We'll talk more about this on tomorrow's video, which we'll get to. But just for now, when I was looking at the Soviet Union stuff, I noticed that it did create an inefficiency, right? Stalin became a bottleneck in the decision-making tree because he found it very difficult to delegate stuff. But also because everybody was scared of him, they found it difficult to take ownership of anything. So this actually became an operational issue within the Soviet Union because, you know, on the one hand, he was having to make decisions about, you know, massive things, wars, armies, you know, allocation of heavy industry budget and things like this. And then it would be like, look, we've got a new sign in Moscow. Do we paint it red or yellow? And like, it's literally, nobody wants to take the decision. You can imagine in the various commissars and in the Politburo and so on, everybody's being like, hey, I'm not touching that. So everything ended up going up to Stalin. And then Stalin got it. And he was like, what? Do you know how busy I am? Do you want the sign red or yellow? Well, who cares? Get out. But then the problem was if they made the decision on the yellow sign, Stalin was like, what? It should have been red. What's wrong? So you see the problem, right? So he couldn't delegate. Like they made, if they took the decision on themselves, it would inevitably be wrong. But if they passed it up, he'd get pissed off at them. So what it meant was stuff would be on Stalin's desk for like 10 months before he could get around to it. So this is inefficient. You could argue more inefficient even than some of our systems. You know, in Britain's got a terrible bureaucracy, but at least some powers are devolved down, right? So this is something we can talk about another day. Anything else on NRX, its legacy, Yarvin, etc.? I mean, are there any good bits of NRX? I always think that the one good NRX author that's still worth reading and going back to was Spandrel. I like Spandrel. Now, you know, the bio-Leninism and the IQ shredder and all this sort of stuff. I always thought he was the most dynamic of them. But yeah, what were your thoughts?
I didn't read a whole lot of Spandrel. I mean, I know his name was thrown around a lot back in the day, especially, and I read some of his ideas. This is where neo-reaction bothers me like it bothers you. They pass off someone else's idea as their own. The idea of bio-Leninism, that the idea that you pick the losers in the old regime, right, and then you empower them in the revolution to take over, that they'll be loyal to you. That's Aristotle. Aristotle says that a tyrant will bring in foreigners who he can then use in the military to oppress his own people because they don't care, right? You can't use your own state army to do it necessarily because they're arresting their own relatives. If you have a, you know, cadre of foreigners in your army, then who cares? And so, yeah, there's a lot of accuracy in what Spandrel says here, but that's not his idea. That's Aristotle's. That's other political philosophers that he's passing off as his own.
Do you know who else has this idea?
Who?
Ironically, Karl Marx. Karl Marx, when he's talking about Napoleon in particular, when he's talking not when he's talking about the, I think it's Napoleon III, the counter gangs. Do you remember I was talking with Caleb Morpin about this? There's that whole passage in Marx where he's like, look, Napoleon had the scum, the vagabonds, the thieves, the scoundrels, and so on. And he made this little counter gang on himself. Side, and then when he actually got into power, obviously these scumbags, he could do away with them, but for the time being they were a decent little counter gang around himself. That was Marx who said that. So
yeah, and so again, it's not that, say, you know, everything that every NRX author said was false, right? The one is, overall, a thing is what a thing does. What does NRX do? Well, what it does is it defends the establishment and misdirects right-wing men away from the real issues that are affecting them. So these issues are weaponized in order to get them to go in another direction, more amenable to the interests of Yarvin himself. And then second of all, they appropriate ideas from other people without giving attribution as if it were their own. Unch and Spandrel in that case, or they just don't get the guy right at all, like Moldbug and Carlyle. And so I think that the NRX movement was successful for what it meant to do. But I think what is surprising to a lot of people, probably in your audience, is that it wasn't what we thought it was supposed to be. So there's a saying that I had from a friend of mine, or friend of the family's, who said that if smart people do something stupid, they're probably doing something else. Right. So if you look at the exoteric take looks stupid, like when I looked at his factually incorrect statements, I'm like, yeah, but is there something else going on behind all that? Because, you know what, somebody that successful really get that far if they didn't have the intellectual background to get there. And I'm like, well, this is my best guess. And some of the stuff he does admit to of what he was really trying to do. And from his point of view, he was successful. And I think that's why he went mask off. I think that's why he wrote in the Grey Mirror, the Elves and Hobbits articles, because he's kind of like, we won now. And now I can tell you what this whole thing was really about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I it's not just him. I often think the a kind of adjacent sphere that kind of sat alongside Yarvin in a way was the BAP sphere, Bronze Age Pervert and Frau. I don't know if you'd include, you wouldn't classically say that BAP was NRX, right? But it's not difficult now to look back on Bronze Age mindset and just be like, yeah, he was talking about a Bronze Age mindset for Israel. It's like a Bronze Age, Bronze Age mindset, but for Israel, or Bronze Age mindset, but for the American empire as controlled by the people in Washington right now, Ben Shapiro's empire, right? I'm not saying that's the whole thing, but it's looking more that way as the weeks, months, and years pass on. You know, like all of these elements, like was it all of just a psyop all along to try to get people into a mindset to support this shit that we're seeing now?
I would say it is. And I would say that, you know, in card games is what's called a tell. So if you look at people's facial expressions, you can see ticks or whatever, and that'll cue you off to think they have a good hand or not. When you're doing a nudge, wink, wink, I have family in the CFR. And also, by the way, if the CFR shows up on the news, that's where real history is happening. That does seem to me to be an attempt at saying, hey, look, for those in the know, those that really know, you know, this is what we're doing. And now, to what extent was this sort of like an ongoing process where, like, you know, at the beginning, maybe Yarvin didn't have this all fully figured out, but he just knew, you know, what the broader arc was going to be, and he just starts filling it out. I think that that's possible. And then also too, this his what he's done is, and this is so effective, right? Because there was this alt-right, anti-Zionist, you know, backlash. The idea then becomes you take all these disaffected men on that side who could be a real problem for you, and you then sort of make a transposition in their brain where they think they're fighting the power, i.e. you, but they're fighting for you and they don't realize it. That, I mean, you look at that and it's hard to believe that was an accident. It's hard to believe that was an accident because that's a really subtle, difficult thing to pull off. But he pulled it off. And, you know, I think that explains a lot of some of the bad takes on Venezuela we've been seeing from the usual suspects. It's like they've some people went all the way in and got reprogrammed and some people didn't. And those who didn't, you know, are the ones that are still criticizing all this.
There's something I also wanted to mention. And again, it's kind of not exactly the same thing, but it's adjacent again, because it's what grew out of these things. There's a kind of neo-reaction adjacent kind of trad sphere that grew up in about 2022, 23, 24. And I always remember there was this essay by this female author called Peachy Keenan. Are you familiar with her works, Todd?
I know the name, but not her work.
And Peachy, and when the October 7 attack happened, penned this essay around that time. She penned this essay. Now, bear in mind, to her audience, this was a female Catholic trad. And she penned this essay revealing that actually when she grew up, she celebrated Hanukkah and basically grew up in a Jewish household. And therefore, when, you know, October 7th happened, it affected her quite a lot, right? And I thought, isn't that interesting? And she's not the only one. That was just the one I remember. There was several others in this trad sphere who actually weren't originally Catholic, like didn't grow up Catholic. They were actually converts, let's just say, from a different background, who then, when that happened, felt the need to unmask, right? They felt the need to unmask. Let's not forget as well, when we came to BAP and so on, they were also unmasked at a certain time, if you recall. They weren't open about who they were. And this made me, now I reflect on it, this was a kind of weak spot. It was an easy way in for this sort of, you might call it infiltration or subversion or, you know, it was just another way in to end up in the same place that a Bush Republican or a Lindsey Graham would be now.
Yeah. So it's like there's this, there were, you know, the old right even, and, you know, one of the last writers of sort of that strain that people liked was, who was the guy that wrote The New Leviathan, the old right thinker that...
Francis. Yeah.
People like him were becoming disillusioned with the system, right? And if you're a system guy, like our favorite dark elf, then you don't want that. You want them to come back into the system, because if enough of them start leaving, then you can't really control them, and then they become dangerous, and then they might overthrow the system. But you can't say that to their face, because they're not going to come back in then, because they'll know what you're about, right? NRX has a sort of like damage control quality to it, where certain elements of the establishment are like, okay, we're going to talk the language of these disaffected men to get them to listen to us. And we're going to feed them a line, and we're going to keep feeding them a line until we can then reveal the real meaning of the plan once things that they don't know about have finally come to fruition. And then it'll be too late, right? They will have bought the line. And, you know, in their minds, they've won and we've won and they've lost. And that's just sort of like rubbing the hobbit's nose in it.
Now, just before we wrap up on this, Todd, to my mind, well, certainly up until about last week, maybe this Venezuela thing has changed things, but certainly the story of last year, 2025, it's 2026 now, was that a lot of these figures that we've been talking about just suddenly, almost overnight, seemed to become irrelevant. You know, that whole public, that man's world thing, and Bat Sphere, and, you know, Captive Dreamer, who I've had very angry beef with myself, as you know, and Yavin to some extent. They became much less relevant because they were just eclipsed, absolutely eclipsed by Fuentes. He seemed to destroy them. I mean, is that not the case, or is this Venezuela thing kind of upset the apple cart again?
Well, you see, that's interesting, right? Because Nick has positioned himself as a sort of spokesman for that disaffected male base that we're talking about, right? And so he's still very, very critical of the system, right? So from Moldbug's perspective, that's bad, right? We want these guys to become reintegrated back into the system. Whether Nick ever changes on that, I don't know what to say until it happens. So currently he's giving no indication that he is. And I think what we could see here is that there's sort of, it's a Frankenstein monster going off on its own way. Moldbug creates this subculture, seeds people with these ideas, creates this framework for thinking. And he thinks that he can run this whole thing like a computer program and, you know, get enough of them back in. But, you know, might it not be a Gallup and Gertie where there's just an inertial force now of these people? And once Moldbug went mask off with the Hobbits and Dark Elves essay, they're kind of upset. You know, they didn't go away. They didn't, you know, take their medicine. You know, they're going to look for somebody else who is going to say what they want him to say. And yeah, it could very well be that Nick does continue to grow at their expense.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, having watched Nick, and I don't watch every show, but I've watched enough of him, and I've given him his praise. He's charismatic and so on. I do think the extent to which he's a revolutionary, a radical guy, is somewhat overstated. I think that in some ways, and I don't think that if he watches this, I don't think he would disagree with what I'm about to say. I think his preferred state of things would not be to, for example, end the Republic, bringing in a dictator, you know, the coming of Mecha Hitler or something like this. I've never heard him talk along these lines. What he wants is, you know, a purging of Zionist elements from the upper echelons of American power and to reclaim the government. I don't think that he has got, I mean, I've never heard him speak in serious terms about a change of structure. It seems like he imagines America always having a president and Congress and all the rest of it. He just wants to get rid of the Zionist influence. I also think, I mean, I don't know if you saw his conversation with Richard Spencer, who I remain buddies with. You know, I think Nick, perhaps due to generation, perhaps because it's what he's always known, is actually more at peace with elements of living in the modern liberal democracy hellscape, right, than he's more at peace with it than at first meets the eye, if that makes any sense. I can think of much more hardcore and radical voices on each one of those questions is what I'm saying. So in a way, I'm not sure if, I mean, I guess I'll put it a different way. To me, all Nick represents is just this very strong critique of one power group that he wants to sideline. All the rest of the discourse around him is kind of puff and a farmer, really. He's not, I guess what I'm saying is, he's not that big of a, the level of his threat is escalated because of who he's criticizing, not because of the sorts of things he says. I can think of much more radical people on every question.
I would agree that Nick is not the most radical person you could point to, but would you agree that he's more radical? I mean, certainly Moldbug would be right in the crosshairs of his mission, his ambitions, but would you say that he's more radical than Moldbug?
It's an interesting, I mean, they're different types of guys in a way, because I don't see Nick as a theorist in that sense. He's very good at analyzing current politics as it's working, but he very rarely kind of lays out a philosophical vision for a political system and things like this. Whereas, of course, Moldbug presents himself as a political theorist and is, you know, advocating on the BBC for a monarchy and things like this, for like a formal change of the structure of government. So from one perspective, Yavin appears more radical. But then, as the person who truly understands what's, for example, in this book here, Tony Blair's on leadership, you then realize that certain figures within the system, Blair being one of them, are already post-liberal. They have already come to these conclusions. They're already acting in a post-democratic and post-liberal way and in an increasingly authoritarian way. Which then, so if that's the case, you then end up with Yavin in a strange and roundabout way actually being like similar in conclusions to Davos or WEF, or, you know, and if you think about it, it's the same people. Larry Ellison funds him, right? It's the same people. What Peter Thiel wants is what he wants. So anyway, this is very, you know, kind of a difficult thing, because then, as someone myself who understands power, I then have these things is like, well, the thing is, realistically, can we actually divest ourselves of these structures? And this is a much deeper and more difficult question. And I, you know, you can go back to my series, you know, when I critique right-wing ideas, it's very difficult to see how you rewind the revolution of mass and scale. How do you get it to go backwards? How do you get it to, you know, once you're at a certain scale, do you actually inevitably end up with a managerial state? In which case, you then end up with, you know, right, well, what I want is Tony Blair, only a based one. You know what I mean? Which is not a million miles away from where, well, it's basically what Yavin is saying. It basically is what Yavin wants already. And in a strange way, he's already got what he wants, because the power brokers behind him have, you know, let's have a think about it. US aid. What was that? What was Doge? Doge did not succeed in any of its exoteric aims, but it did succeed in its esoteric aim of installing Palantir onto all of the, you know, as a basic spyware in the, in the machinery of the American deep state. So you could say, well, okay, I don't currently have an answer for how you get rid of the massive apparatus of the managerial state without empire collapse, anarchy, barbarism, etc. I mean, can you think of any times where this has happened without absolute disaster in the here and now?
Well, usually what ends up happening is the sort of like fully mature bureaucratic state becomes log-jammed and falls. The Western Roman Empire is a good example. Rolling any of this back without having it first collapse is very, very rare.
So, yeah, I you know, I don't know, like, what the answer is. I guess we wouldn't be sitting here if we did know all the answers. But, yeah. So then you say, well, if you accept this as a reality, the only way you then end up differing from Yavin is exactly who you want the Dark Elves to be. Is that not right?
Yeah. Well, and you know, again, to give credit, in 2007 in UR, Moldbug was very... spoke very highly of his liberal peers as persons, not as policymakers. He criticized their soft power arguments endlessly, but and he said, "Yeah, that's me. That's my people. That whole, you know, managerial now tech class, right?" And so for him, He did say that. But, you know, most people, I just don't think, Red, you are, because they don't really realize he said that. Like, it was right there at the very beginning of You Are. And now when he comes out with Gray Mirror saying all this, and everybody's like, oh, gosh, how could Molebug have done? Molebug told you this back in 2007. He's certainly refined some of this. But none of this should have been a surprise to anybody who actually read You Are, which is also an interesting thing.
All right, Todd. Well, thank you very much. Well, we're going to talk more tomorrow about authoritarian systems and the dangers of fetishizing them. But that's something to come back to. For now, where can people find your stuff, Todd?
Well, they can type in YouTube, the Praise of Folly podcast. You can watch my videos there. And you can contact me and follow me on Twitter at POF podcast.
And I'll just remind people, Foundations of Shakespeare is still available on pre-order. Promo code SHORJAN gets you 25% off the courses. If you get the Foundations of Shakespeare course and this, you'll get, if you show the receipt to the publisher, they'll give you 50% off that as well. So you can get quite a bundle. You basically end up, if you buy it, I think I worked out, if you buy it on the promo code SHORJAN, you basically get this for free. Sort of. Anyway, you can work out the maths yourself. All right. We'll be back tomorrow. Get out, everybody. Go on. If you liked this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.